There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into those conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. They don't need another opinion piece, even by some highly qualified Christian thought leader. What they need is the mind of Christ. Now, how are we going to help give that to people? Well, if you'd like some resources on that subject, visit us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, we'd ask that you sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here in the hour on the air. You could also like The Reconnect on Facebook. You could let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. Hey, if you want to become a part of our book launch team, all you need to do is communicate that on our Facebook page, which is The Reconnect. Let us know you'd like to be a part of our book launch team, and we will send you out the information that you need to participate in that. So it would be a way of you helping us get the word out about Speak the Truth, how to bring God back into every conversation. The book will be released on Monday, but you can get a free downloaded chapter today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Okay, so I want to lead off with, I know you all want to talk about the president's speech to the UN, but I am saving that for tomorrow because I want to be able to actually go through it and digest it and bring to you the most salient tidbits. And I also know that it's what everybody else is talking about right now across the globe. And so I want to give some thoughtful commentary to that subject. So we're going to deal with that tomorrow. Today, I want to talk about what's going on in Atlanta on the campus of Georgia Tech University. You may or may not be aware that two nights ago, a student leader of the Pride Alliance committed suicide by cop. After a vigil related to that, the campus erupted in what I would describe as destructive, violent protests against the police. Now, let me point out again, this individual committed suicide by cop. That is how I will describe what took place after this student called 911 to report an armed and possibly intoxicated, suspicious person fitting his physical description. In the call, quote, according to the article, you can get this in the Washington Post, you can get it at CNN, everybody's using the same quotes. The AP did a big roundup on this. So in the call, Schultz, who is the name of this individual, describes the person as, you have to listen to this, a white male with long blonde hair, white t-shirt, and blue jeans, who is possibly intoxicated, holding a knife, and possibly armed with a gun on his hip. Now, that is the description that was called into 911. Later, we find out that the person who made that call is indeed the individual being described. So, Mr. Schultz called 911, described himself to the police as a white male with long blonde hair, white t-shirt, blue jeans, possibly intoxicated, holding a knife, and possibly armed with a gun on his hip. That is who the police then encountered at the location, described by the person who called 911. And he subsequently charged several police officers, and one of them shot him, one shot, and tragically severed his heart. Now, what is notable about this individual is that he was president of the Pride Alliance at Georgia Tech, a fourth-year computer engineering student, went by the name Scout rather than by his given name Scott, and he preferred pronouns they and them rather than he or him. He posted on the Pride Alliance, his Pride Alliance profile on their website, that he identifies as bisexual, non-binary, and intersex. The student's father, Bill Schultz, said, "I don't think there was a single person that didn't love them." Now, that's the plural pronoun that his child chose in opposition to the male pronoun that would actually apply to his gender as a male. So this is the dad saying, "I don't think there was a single person that didn't love them and cherish them for their involvement in the different causes." The student's father, William Schultz, told reporters that I'm telling you, these journalists go to great pains to not describe this person as male or female, refer to him as his child or the student. So the student's father, William Schultz, told reporters that his child had a 3.9 GPA and was on track to graduate early in December. His mother, I say his mother, that's not what they say. They say Lynn Schultz, the mother, Lynn Schultz told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution over the weekend that I will refer to him as Scott, who went by Scout, identified as neither male nor female, had suffered from anxiety and depression, had spent time in counseling after attempting suicide by hanging 2 years ago. After that, according to his father, this young man went through counseling and, quote, everything seemed fine when he returned to school earlier this month. Let me be very clear that I recognize the very, very tragic reality that this family is experiencing. We just talked about suicide yesterday. We have been talking about the reality of suicide over and over and over again on this show and the impact that it has on concentric circles of people, that it's even hard to define the ripple effects of a person taking their own life. But let me point out to you some things about this story that are important from a Christian worldview perspective, because what I'm trying to help you see is just how desperately confused our culture has become. This is a person whose parents were supportive of his gender nonconformity. So on the one hand, I would say this is a set of parents who are buying into a cultural narrative that says that biological men and biological women, those are not fixed realities. And these are parents who have bought into the gender confusion of their own child. So far, it goes so far that they not only do not call him by his given name, Scott, they call him a pronoun, them and they, and their. This was a person who had friends and was popular and academically successful. This was a person who was leading a student organization. This was a person who had some influence on social media and in social circles where he operated. This is a person who was socially engaged. This was also a person whose cries for help went unheard by a culture that wants so badly to let everyone be whatever they want to be that we utterly failed to provide adequate responses in terms of the mental illness that this person was suffering. There's no way that a person at this depth of mental illness can go through, you know, one seasonal round of counseling and be judged to be okay. This is clearly not a person who was okay. But our culture is so committed to the narrative that people can be whatever they want to be, even if what they want to be is not what they are, that we set ourselves up for the kinds of scenarios that this person ultimately experienced. This was a person who was looking for a fight. He yelled at the cops, "Shoot me!" His father said he was recently enamored with the Antifa movement. And I would say this is a person who committed suicide by cop and who identified himself as a male in his 911 call. Please don't lose sight of the fact that he knew who he was, that he was in deep conflict with reality, and that he was mentally ill, and he should have received the care that a mentally ill person would receive. Why did he not receive that kind of intervention for mental illness? Because culturally, we have all collectively bought into the lie that gender is something that is imagined, can be reimagined, can be fluid, and ultimately it doesn't matter whether or not we are aligned with reality in terms of our gender identity and sexual expression. Friends, if you want evidence of the deep confusion that sexual orientation and gender identity issues produce, this is the story you've got to familiarize yourself with. This is the story you've got to be able to talk. You've got to be able to talk about. This is a story about suicide. Yes, let's not lose sight of that. This is a story about mental illness. Let's not lose sight of that. This is also a story about the culture, and the parents, and the school, and others who are circling around this individual. enabling an absolutely dysphoric understanding of reality. Reactions to the Georgia Tech campus, reactions on the Georgia Tech campus, excuse me, are frankly evidence that we no longer know how to respond when something happens that we disagree with. Some are going to use any excuse to rage against the, you know, quote unquote, established order. But if you're familiar with the location of Georgia Tech and that campus, then like me, you probably have some suspicions that those who are engaged in violent, destructive riots on campus against the police are actually not Georgia Tech students and are actually not there because they knew or loved or supported the gay activist agenda, or I should say gender nonconforming agenda of this particular student. So I'm certainly hoping and praying that the riots last night do not spill over into the neighboring or into the neighborhoods that surround the Georgia Tech campus. And certainly we need to continue to lift up everybody on that campus for, you know, not just today, friends, because this is a systemic cultural issue that we are now dealing with, or we're failing to deal with. And I would say we need to be dealing with. Okay, let me turn my attention to another story. This one out of Russia. I actually have three stories today about guys who have died. So I know that's going to start to be depressing to everyone. But sometimes the stories of death make us really consider life more seriously. And certainly death brings worldview into very sharp focus. So this is about Stanislav Petrov. Now, if you don't know who Stanislav Petrov is, the article on NPR, and actually the movie by the same title, is the man who saved the world. Stanislav Petrov was a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Union's Air Defense Forces. His job was to monitor the USSR's satellite system. For those of you who don't know what the USSR was, it was actually the Unified Soviet Republic prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, when President Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall." Okay, so this is the era that we're talking about. So Stanislav Petrov was a lieutenant colonel in the USSR's Air Defense Forces. He was on duty the night of September the 26th, 1983. So we're not talking about ancient history here, which maybe doesn't surprise you since I'm talking about the fact that this guy recently died. So anyway, Stanislav Petrov is facing an array of computers that are all sounding an alarm. Those computers are indicating that the United States had launched nuclear armed intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, for those of you who have been paying attention to North Korea, you know that nuclear armed intercontinental ballistic missiles can travel halfway around the world in 15 or 20 minutes. And so it was Mr. Petrov's job to then raise the alarm raised by the computers to his superiors. But he didn't do that. He didn't do that. Why did he not do it? Well, because he thought it was curious, almost remarkable. In fact, out of the way he expected it to happen, that he was getting a reading that the United States had launched five nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missiles. Why, you say? Because he had been trained to believe that when it happened, it was going to all happen, that the United States was going to let loose with its full arsenal. And he knew that the United States had far more than five nuclear weapons to send toward the USSR. So he paused, and he considered, and he trusted his gut. I love the words that are used in here. Mr. Petrov gave a 2013 interview to the BBC in which he said, "Look, there was no rule about how long we were allowed to think before we reported." So now you got to think that a guy who has been taught to follow the rules and who is a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Union's Air Defense Forces, he certainly doesn't want nuclear war. He certainly doesn't want his own country to be annihilated by a nuclear weapon. But he is a thinking person. I love that. I love that. He says, "I knew that every second of procrastination took away valuable time, that the Soviet Union's military and political leadership needed to be informed without delay. All I had to do was reach for the phone, raise the direct line to the top commanders, but I couldn't move." Petrov, the article by NPR, says, sensed something wasn't adding up. That sense, my friends, is called intuition. Intuition is inexplicable by science. If you want evidence that there is something more than that which can be measured, listen to people when they talk about, I just felt it in my gut. I sensed it. It raised the hair on the back of my neck. My intuition told me. Conscience led me to believe. None of those, my friends, is measurable by any sort of empirical data. I can't right now test my colleague across the studio for an intuition meter. There isn't one. There's no thermometer of gut reaction. Some people can trust their gut. And he says, I didn't trust the computers. I trusted my gut. Think about that for a moment. He actually didn't trust what the scientists were telling him to trust. He didn't trust the computers. He trusted his gut. He trusted his intuition. He trusted what he had been trained to expect. What he had been trained to expect is that the United States would unleash all of its nuclear weapons, not just five. He finally says, I just had a feeling. I just had a feeling that this wasn't right. And so I waited. The article then says, after several nerve-jangling minutes, Petrov didn't send the computer warning to his superiors. He simply checked to see if the computers had malfunctioned. Well, that process took him 23 minutes, and guess what? If there had been nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missiles, they would have landed at the 20-minute mark. That's when he says, well, I realized since nothing had happened, it wasn't a real strike. We would have already known about it. And it was, I admit, quite a relief. Mr. Petrov died on May the 19th at age 77 in a suburb outside of Moscow, living in relative obscurity. But let me just say this. Mr. Petrov, who is described as the man who saved the world in a docudrama by that name featuring Kevin Costner in 2015, sums up his experience in this way. He says, I never considered myself a hero because this was my job. And then he says, they were lucky it was me on shift that night. Let me just say, first of all, that I'm grateful that Stanislav Petrov trusted his gut, trusted his intuition, and did not trust the computer screens in front of him. I am thankful that Stanislav Petrov was the person sitting at that console of computers on the night of September the 26th, 1983. You and I would be talking about the nuclear war of 1983 had we survived it, had this man not been the man sitting there that night. As you consider the fragility of life, as you consider the fragility of nation states, as you consider the nuclear armament now of North Korea and the nuclear aspirations of countries like Iran, it wouldn't just be, you know, us looking for nuclear weapons coming from one location. We're now talking about a proliferation of places and spaces and regimes from which nuclear weapons could be sent around the world. God give us more men and women like Stanislav Petrov, who will not necessarily trust the screens in front of them, but trust their intuition that we really do not have the will to annihilate one another unto death. All right, friends, the other thing I want to raise about this story is the title is so bad. It says, The Man Who Saved the World. I want to remind you that the man who saved the world actually lived and died 2,000 years ago. That when we talk about redemption and we talk about the redemptive arc of history, when we talk about salvation and we talk about a savior, we as Christians have to be exclusively talking about and sharing with others the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. All right, I got one more thing to share with you about a friend and colleague in ministry who died recently, and his name is Michael Cromartie. Michael Cromartie, if you've ever wanted to know, hey, what does Carmen aspire to be when she grows up? Well, Michael Cromartie is the kind of person in the culture, of Christian in the culture, who I aspire to be when I grow up. Now, to say that's kind of ridiculous because he wasn't actually that much older than I am now. But Michael Cromartie is a person who stood at the intersection of journalism and religious thought leaders across the country. He was the vice president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And one of the things that he did was gather groups of reporters and leaders from sort of the religious, political realm into something that was called, or is called, the Faith Angle Forum. And what I want to share with you is the reaction to the death of Michael Cromartie by a person on the secular left who is who recognizes and acknowledges publicly that he is an atheist, and what he had to say about Michael Cromartie. And there's a reason I want to read this to you. I want to read this to you because this is the kind of testimony that you and I ought to be looking for by the secular left when we die. This is the kind of testimony that atheists and humanists and naturalists and scientismists and every other kind of ist that is out there, this is the kind of testimony that they ought to be making about Christians when we die. He says, "Here's what I learned from my years with Michael Cromartie. In a world full of religious hatred, religious violence, religious oppression, and religious stupidity, there's a better kind of faith. It's rich, sane, and healthy. It can teach us to think critically, not just about society at large, but about religion itself." And then he makes these observations based on his experiences at the Faith Angle Forum and with Michael Cromartie, that good religion is sensible about science, good religion has integrity, good religion pursues justice, good religion is humble, and then above all, he says, good religion is more about questions than about answers. I would say it's more about conversations, but I'll give him that. And then in the very end, he says this to his non-believing friends. He says, look, the secular ideologies that many non-believers have adopted, atheism, progressivism, environmentalism, feminism, multiculturalism, we all have belief systems. We can practice them well or poorly, just as Christians, Jews, or Muslims can. When we substitute dogma for thought, dismiss other points of view, or excuse violence in name of righteousness, we're practicing bad religion, and we too must reflect and learn. So, here's what I want to say as a reflection upon this reflection by an atheist on a Christian. Okay, so these are the reflections of an atheist about a Christian and the goodness of the religion that he learned from him. I want to direct us to a particular verse in 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 12, the Lord commands us to keep our conduct among the Gentiles. You could also use the word pagans or non-believers there. Keep your conduct among the non-believers honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Friends, may we wear ourselves out. May we wear ourselves out in conversations addressing the very real questions that very real people in the culture have today. And may we do so in a way that honors Jesus. Michael Cromartie was a magnificent ambassador of the kingdom of God. And he wasn't afraid of the people who deny the faith, and he wasn't afraid of their questions. He recognized that the kingdom reality stands up against all of the kingdoms of this world. And he was a person who understood that the truth of Christianity, Jesus Christ, stands up in heaven, in fact, even when those on the earth deny him. And so I want to thank God for the life and the ministry of Michael Cromartie. And I want to encourage all of you to be praying for Peter Wehner, who has taken over those responsibilities for the Faith Angle Forum at the Ethics and the Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. It's an essential conversation for us to be having in our culture. And if you want to know where are journalists getting their information about religion, they're getting a lot of it from the Ethics and Public Policy Center through their engagement in these Faith Angle forums with Christian thought leaders and academicians from across the country and around the world. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It is a listener-supported show by people just like you. What does that mean? That means I need you to go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and click the Donate Now button. I need you to help us do what we do here on the air every day, in order that we can keep doing what we do here on the air every day, in order that we can keep posting resources to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday at reconnectwithcarmen.com, in order that we can continue producing resources that hopefully get you off the sidelines and into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. Hey, visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com, become a reconnector, and then join me right back here in just a minute. We'll be right back. Hey, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is The Reconnect. We are seeking to put God back in his place, right where he belongs, in the middle of every conversation. Well, I think that my guest today would say, let's put God where he belongs, right at the center of our affections. Let's be sure that we are cultivating an intimacy with God, not just that we know about God or are doing good things for God, but that we are actually spending intentional time with him, pursuing God, just because he's God. All right, so we're talking about things that people in the culture are talking about, and we're addressing the concerns that you and I face each and every day as Christians in the culture. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And when we talk about being able to speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day, one of the things that we talk about is we have to cultivate our understanding of and our integration with the mind of Christ. And so to that point, we now press ourselves. And so let me have a conversation with Mike Cosper. He's the director of Harbor Media. He's the host of the podcast Cultivated, Conversations about Faith and Work. He's also the author of three books, Rhythms of Grace, The Stories We Tell, and co-author of Faith Mapping. His latest book is Recapturing the Wonder. So I guess that means you're technically an author of four books. Latest is Recapturing the Wonder, Transcendent Faith in a Disenchanted World. You can check it all out at harbormedia.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, which I just did, at Mike Cosper. That's C-O-S-P-E-R. Mike, welcome to The Reconnect.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, so you got big words in the title of your book, so we're going to start right there so that people know what we're talking about. What is a transcendent faith, and what is a disenchanted world?
Yeah, so I'll start with disenchanted. I think the whole idea of a disenchanted world is a world in which there's an explanation for everything. There's a scientific explanation for everything. It's a world where there's no mysteries left. It's a world where we think we've got everything kind of figured out, and that's what the last, 300 to 500 years of Western history has given us. It's this modern world where we think we know everything. We think we've sorted out the universe, and as a result, it gives us a lack of a sense of expectation around anything spiritual or religious at all. We don't anticipate encountering the supernatural. We don't anticipate encountering the transcendent. And so the idea of the book is to say, first off, maybe the world isn't the way we think it is. Maybe it isn't so disenchanted. And second of all, maybe there are opportunities to encounter the presence of God in our everyday lives in a way that is, in fact, transcendent and beautiful and life-changing.
So as you were describing that, I will just admit to you that this thing that my mother said to me, and it never occurred to me that maybe I think the way I think about everything in part because of this. I mean, I can hear her over and over again on my way out the door saying, all right, girls, it'd be me and my sister, Tiana, expect always the unexpected and anticipate miracles because with God, all things are possible. Like I remember her sending us off with that set of expectations. And what I hear you saying is that's really not the set of expectations that most people in our culture are going out the door with every day.
That's right. And I think even in our churches at times, we have a way of sort of disenchanting our own religious experiences. We primarily think about the Bible as a text to be taken apart and mastered and to have all the answers sorted out for us, as opposed to seeing it the way it describes itself as this living fire, this word of God, this sword that cuts and divides. In order for the Bible to be a powerful thing, it has to be more than simply another text that we can take apart and figure out. So yeah, I think we have to have a sense of anticipation about all of life, but that probably begins with us having a sense of anticipation about our spiritual lives.
All right, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about where do I even, if I have been a person who has literally been neglecting the intangible, if I'm a person who's been literally neglecting my own soul, where do I start? What's the practical first step sort of in recapturing the wonder?
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably, it's probably a little different for everybody, which is, sounds like a cop-out answer, and maybe it is. But I think one of the first places to start is by trying to find a different way. One of the things I talk about in the book is trying to find different ways of engaging with the scriptures. And the church gives us, the historical church gives us wonderful resources here, but practices like just like learning to pray the Psalms and allow the imagery of the Psalms to kind of envelop our imaginations and shape our imaginations. But approaching the Bible as a text to be prayed through rather than a text to be kind of studied and again, taken apart. Another great practice that's, you know, a very old practice is they refer to as Ignatian prayer, where you might take a short story from the Gospels and meditate on it and imagine yourself in the story, try to imagine the details of the story, imagine what it was like to be in the presence of Jesus as he touched someone and healed them. What does it feel like? How do you think you would have reacted if he had reached out and touched you and healed you? But the idea there with both of those practices is to come to the scriptures from a different angle. But there are other ways too. I think learning to have good spiritual friendships and spiritual conversations can dramatically open up our experience of everyday life. Taking things like meals seriously as a place where we're receiving our daily bread. You know, the scriptures tell us that everything that we have is a gift, and if we pause and take a moment and acknowledge, wow, this is actually a gift. Like, this isn't just something that I went and earned my money and bought and paid for and cooked. In spite of all of that, it comes as a gift from God. It's daily bread, and it's a blessing, and we want to receive it with thanks.
I love that. So I think that part of what I really like, and again, folks, we're talking to Mike Cosper, and we're talking about Recapturing the Wonder, Transcendent Faith in a Disenchanted World. You can check it out at harbormedia.com. One of the things that I really like is that this is kind of an invitation on a journey, and it's a journey toward something that I think for a lot of people is itself intangible, the concept of peace or the concept of communion with God. Let's talk about intimacy with God. What is that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's something that I think this is a place where we really struggle in our contemporary moment with. One of the things a theme that you see in the Gospels is Jesus going away to lonely places to pray by himself, or, you know, Jesus heals someone and he says, you know, go show yourself to the priest, but don't say anything to anybody else. There's a sense of sort of intimacy between God and those he heals, or between Jesus and the Father. And I think that's something that, you know, I think Jesus is modeling something for us, which is, there are supposed to be spaces in our lives and parts of our lives that really remain between us and God. Our devotional lives, our prayer lives, aspects of those can and should and will be shared. But, you know, in a social media age, the moment we read a powerful quote in a book, or the moment a scripture, you know, resonates with us and makes us think or moves us, it's a pretty natural inclination to grab our phone and go post that on Facebook or Twitter or wherever else. And in a sense, I think we find ourselves losing some of that sense of intimacy, because whatever we experience, whatever kind of transcendence we might experience or intimacy with God we might experience, we immediately turn around and share it with everyone around us. And it can become cheapened in some ways. Henri Nouwen had this metaphor that he would talk about with intimacy with God was like having a small fire in the hearth of a small cabin, and that as the fire burns in the hearth, if the front door is closed, the hearth, you know, the small fire can warm the whole room. But the more you crack the door open, the wider the door gets, the colder the room gets, and the smaller the fire gets. I think that's an an apt metaphor for something that we really struggle with, which is to cultivate something that is deeply personal between us and God's presence, God's spirit.
So Mike, I think that one of the challenges that every single one of us faces is sort of the overwhelming busyness of life. Now, some of that is simply our perception that we have to be accessible 24/7 to other people, and we have to be on social media, and we have to. And so what I would love to hear you help people understand is sort of the start. In order to start some of these practical things, you actually have to stop some other things. Talk about the practical ways that we make room for these kinds of habits in our everyday lives.
Well, one of the first things I always think is, and I always try to encourage people, is don't be a hero. don't try to take on too much too quickly when you're trying to sort of change the patterns of your life. Because what we want to do is we want to build a new way of life. We don't just want to throw something in on a way of life that is disenchanted and that does make intimacy with God difficult. So instead, we want to find new patterns for our whole days and days, weeks, and months. So I encourage people just to take one small step at a time. That might be that you give yourself 5 minutes to read a psalm and to pray. But the key thing is that whatever it is that you do, make it consistent and make it something that you can build upon. I think if we think of it that way, you think of adding little habits, little moments in the day where we kind of check in spiritually and see where our heart is and how we may or may not be experiencing God's presence. Adding these little building blocks over time can really reshape the way we think, really, renew our minds, and reorient us towards a sense of the world such that we have a real and active knowledge that God is with us. And that's the gift of the gospel, that God is with us. You know, he promises to be with us. Those aren't just words. That's something we can actually live in and experience.
All right. I'm so glad that you used the word gospel, because there's a quote that I would invite you to explain to everybody. So y'all, Mike says this in the book, Recapturing the Wonder, Transcendent Faith in a Disenchanted World. You say, if we fail to understand the gospel, then the disciplines become a means to an end, a way of trying to earn God's attention and favor. What is the right understanding of the gospel that helps us enter into spiritual disciplines that actually lead to intimacy and communion with God that's not a means to an end?
Yeah, I mean, the gospel is this wonderful news that the kingdom of God is here. That through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the kingdom has come, and life with God is available to us now. If we understand that to be a fact, then essentially the door is open, the opportunity is open to live a life in communion with God here now, in spite of our failings, in spite of our flaws, in spite of our shortcomings. I heard a friend.
So, Mike, I know you can do this. Let's have a little repartee. Let me push back against that and say, now wait a second. This is the world, and here, we sort of run things. Yes, there's a God, he's in heaven, and Christians believe in that whole pie in the sky heaven nonsense, or maybe heaven is for real, but that's for some other day. When you say the kingdom of God is here and that I can have a relationship with God right now, you sound like a crazy person. And so answer me as the cultural person who is genuinely has only ever experienced the world as disenchanted, and explain to me or invite me into the reality of the gospel.
Yeah, I think it does sound crazy. But I think it's also something that if we're honest with ourselves, it's something that we crave. We crave transcendent moments, whether it's, the birth of a child or a beautiful landscape or some chance encounter that is profound and moving. we crave those kinds of things, and each one of them feels, you know, there's these moments in life where we feel like we're experiencing something bigger than simply what is in front of us. Again, I think the birth of a child is a perfect example of this, where there's something more happening than just a biological process. Something beautiful is happening, something profound. And, you know, my pushback to someone who says, hey, I think it sounds crazy, this whole idea that the presence of God is real and manifest in the world around us, my pushback would be to go, you know, tell me about a moment in your life that felt beautiful, where you experienced beauty, whether it was in art or in relationship with other people or just in nature itself. And tell me if your, you know, two-dimensional explanation of the world, that this is, you know, that it's just a good luck, you know, that we happen to exist. Does that account for those kinds of experiences? Does that explain what we feel when we look at beautiful art, or when we fall in love, or when we look at our children? Can that account for how profound those experiences are? And I think ultimately they can't. It falls short. There's something more going on. And there's a reason why we chase after those moments. There's a reason why we long for those transcendent kind of experiences.
Absolutely. All right, friends. The book is Recapturing the Wonder, Transcendent Faith in a Disenchanted World. The author is Mike Cosper, C-O-S-P-E-R. You can follow him on Twitter, at Mike Cosper. You can check it all out at harbormedia.com. Hey, Mike, thank you for being with us here today on The Reconnect. Thank you for sharing this with the Christ and Pop Culture folks. Members of Christ and Pop Culture can actually get a free copy of this book through the 22nd of November. So that's kind of cool. So thank you for doing that as well.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Mike. All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold, where we lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start or engage with others in conversations that may not on the surface appear to be about Jesus or God or anything transcendent, but where you can be the introducer of wonder, where you can be the person who actually brings the transcendent to bear in a disenchanted world, to now borrow that language from Mike. I don't know, I might borrow that language from Mike a lot. You never know. I might just adopt it for myself. I kind of like it. Okay, so I had a heavy-duty worldview piece to bring to you from the New York Times by David Brooks. I'm actually just going to commend it to your reading and study. It's entitled When Life Asks for Everything. I think it's an important read, not only because it's a comprehensive worldview analysis, but because David Brooks does it in such a way that will not have secular people thinking, this is all just about religion. So let me commend that to you. It's When Life Asks for Everything. It is the opinion column on September the 19th in the New York Times by David Brooks. I'm setting it aside right now for another Below the Fold, because a friend of mine posted on their Facebook page something that, in my view, is evidence of how we bear witness to Christ in the context of the reality of our fallenness and brokenness. And so my friend posted this. He says, as someone who believes that the scriptures written about Jesus are true, I've been thinking a lot about healing lately. A little over 6 months ago, I fell. Now, let me just say that a little over 6 months ago, he fell off a ladder while he was cleaning the gutters of his house. And so he's about my age, and he's got a family, and he was dutifully doing the dad job of cleaning out the gutters. And he fell that entire distance from the top of the ladder, straight back, and actually landed on the ladder. How that's possible, I don't exactly know. So, he says here on Facebook, according to my doctor, quote, I need a new birth certificate because the odds are extremely thin that I would survive such a fall. I did survive, but I was not unscathed. Two fractured vertebrae and also a fractured hand. But I consider my survival and the fact that I got up to walk an incredible miracle. I don't know why I survived. Well, as his friend, I know why he survived. But he says, I'm so grateful for all the additional time with my family and friends, and I pray that whatever time I have left in this life is not squandered, and that the presence of God's redeeming love in my life brings comfort, joy, peace, laughter, love, and holy influence to everyone I know. One thing I know for sure about this life is that it is fleeting. The time we have together is sacred time because everything we see around us is, including us, deteriorating. I still have the fracture in my right hand. It's been a reminder to me of the fall and of the physical deterioration that is our earthly destiny. Mine is apparently an injury so rare that only one of three highly regarded hand surgeons recognized everything that was happening with it. He goes on then to describe in detail what's going on in his hand, and I will not belabor all of that medical information because, as you know, I'm not good with big science words. So here we go. Moving ahead, he says, the pain is always there, but it's dull and manageable until that one guy with that extra ambitious handshake reaches over or offers a slight twist or an unintentional extension of the wrist creates a shot of pain of the fractured bone pressing into something else, maybe. It's so intense, it takes my breath away for several minutes. It makes me think of that one coach or teacher or professor who is unpredictably fierce. The coach who's always mean and tough and leaves a dull ache. You know what to expect, and sometimes you can deal with it, but the sharp, unpredictable pain, however, is like the one you're never sure whether or not they're going to unleash on you or unleash on your teammate. So you just live in fear of the next moment. Okay, if anybody has ever lived in a household with a person who is an alcoholic, this is actually similar to what they describe in terms of living in constant fear of the person and the reaction that you're going to get from them. So I lift this up because he's not just describing the kinds of physical pains that we encounter, but the psychological and spiritual pain that we experience. So moving on, he talks about the fact that this pain is probably going to be with him forever. They don't have any intention at this point of medically correcting what's wrong with him. And he starts then this exploration of healing. And he talks about what it means to him to actually believe, even after a lot of prayer, that he may not be physically healed. And he says, it's one thing to have to learn to walk again. But then I start thinking about my hand and perhaps even being able to feel or not feel pain. And there you can think about people who you know who have had the kinds of falls and the kinds of accidents that Johnny Erickson Tada has shared with us that leave them crippled in ways that they will not experience healing in this life. But they certainly not only look forward to the healing that lies ahead, but for an intimacy with God and a real life of purpose lived here and now. So he says, if I want my days on this earth to be marked by comfort, peace, joy, laughter, love, and holy influence, I cannot depend on my own righteousness to fuel all of that. I have to depend on the love of God to reach down with his right hand and sustain me. I have to depend on his righteousness, not my own. In the scriptures, there's a story of some guys who brought their friend to Jesus because he couldn't walk. It's in Matthew chapter 9. And my friend goes on to talk about those friends and their commitment on that day and Jesus's authority, not only over sin and death, which is harder to forgive, by the way, than to bring physical healing. And he says to the paralyzed man, get up, take your mat, and go home. And then Jesus has the same thing Jesus has already told me, says my friend, get up and walk. He has rescued me, and he has made my rescue from sin possible. He's already told me your sins are forgiven. And somehow that seems more impossible than to heal my body. All right, friends, this is the kind of testimony I want each and every one of us to have every day in our social media. Pain is real. Life is difficult. Jesus is bigger than all of that. I want us to be gospel people in the culture today, and I want us to be praying for our friends who are suffering. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. That's literally all I've got time for today. Join me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.